Very good. Staggering, surprising. Normally I'd stand here in lectures and it would take 10 minutes for that to happen, so you should come more often. Well, welcome everyone. My name is Bruce McDonald and I'm Director of Alumni and Development here at Swinburne. And it's so wonderful to see this lecture theatre full of so many interesting people and people who are great friends of ours here at Swinburne. I'd like to acknowledge a few things, but before I do that, if I could just ask, I suspect that most of you now know the rules, you've got to turn off your mobile phones, but if you haven't, do it very quietly and surreptitiously under the desk. I'd like to welcome the following people here and acknowledge their presence here today. The Chancellor, Bill Scales, AO, who'll be introducing Anousheh, Bill. The Vice-Chancellor, Professor Ian Young. Some former Swinburne councillors, Kath Watson and Jean Austin. Trevor Brown was going to be here but hasn't perhaps arrived yet, so in his absence Trevor will perhaps arrive later, and I brought attention to him, so I'm sorry about that. So when Trevor comes in you can say I'd also like to acknowledge the President of the Iranian Society of Victoria, Mehdi Sudi. Thank you for coming and thank you for bringing along a number of your colleagues from the Iranian Society. Fantastic. Maddie's also doing a PhD here at Swinburne in Iris, so it's fantastic. That's great. The connection is wonderful. Also, the Iranian side of Anousheh is covered, but also the American side is covered, because here in the audience we have Ambassador Pete Peterson and his wife, lovely wife, Bea. And Pete was the first post-war US ambassador to Vietnam, and he's now an adjunct professor here at Swinburne. His wife is an alumnus of ours, so we have both sides covered. We have to engineer it, but it's all covered. A lot of staff and students from the Centre for Astrophysics and Supercomputing are here, so I welcome them, and it's them that's really brought the connection between Anousheh and Swinburne to be, so that's wonderful. And also we have many alumni, staff and friends of the university here, so welcome to all of you. And I'd now like to introduce you to Bill Scales, the Chancellor, who will officially and formally welcome and introduce Anousheh.
Thank you, Bruce, and good evening, everybody, and Hosh Amadid. It is an honour, of course, to be here tonight to introduce Anousheh Ansari. To deliver the first of the Chancellor's centenary lectures. On September 18, in 2006, Anousheh made world headlines when she joined the crew of the International Space Station on an 8-day trip aboard the Russian Soyuz spacecraft. In doing so, she became the very first female private space explorer, and I think just as significantly, the first Iranian, first female Muslim, and may I add, the very first, but hopefully not the last, Swinburne student to make it into space. Her achievement in space alone, I think, has inspired people, particularly women and young women, all over the world, to go for what might seem to be the absolute impossible. And of course, as Anousheh will tell us, not only to seek the impossible, to make the impossible happen. The fact that she also wrote the very first space blog, inviting readers to share in her experience, I think you'll find tonight is very characteristic of this wonderful, capable woman. This too captured international attention with her personal website and the blog, which attracted, just think about this, over 50 million hits from readers all around the world. That Anousheh is in fact a Swinburne student is something that clearly we at the university are enormously proud of. Our Centre for Astrophysics and Supercomputing, as Bruce mentioned, I think is one of the largest, and we know this, astronomy centres in Australia and home to, of course, internationally renowned researchers. And of course, none of our rival research centres can ever boast of the fact that they have a student who's been on a spacecraft participant, let alone the very first female one. But of course, it's not just Anousheh's accomplishments with regard to her lifelong dream to go into space that makes her such an exceptional woman. She's also an enormously successful business person. For example, in 2001, Anousheh served as the co-founder, chief executive officer, and chairman of the board for Telecom Technologies. After earning 3 quite separate US patents and growing to 250 employees, the company enjoyed a 100% growth year on year. Under her leadership, Telecom Technologies earned recognition as one of Inc. magazine's 500 fastest growing companies and Deloitte and Touche's fastest 500 technology companies. The company also successfully merged with Sonos Networks to provide IP-based voice infrastructure products in a deal that was worth approximately $750 million. That's real money. Anousheh's business and space accomplishments have even been more impressive in some ways when you realise that she immigrated to the United States as a teenager who could not speak one word of English. She immersed herself in education, earning a bachelor degree in electronics and computer engineering from George Mason University, followed by a master's degree in electronic engineering from George Washington University. And I think I can actually assure you, just on the quiet, that we understand she's doing actually quite well in her master's degree here at Swinburne. Although now an American citizen, Anousheh's Iranian heritage is still very important to her, and I'm delighted that members of Melbourne's Iranian community have been able to join us here tonight. You would know how important that community is, not only to Victoria, but to Australia. And we are absolutely delighted that we have so many of you here tonight. It is just wonderful that you're here with us. Anousheh, I would like to sincerely thank you for taking the time to visit Swinburne. The fact that this happens to be during the year we celebrate our 100 years, I think is particularly important for us. So can I now ask you to come up and really tell us about your experiences. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming here tonight. I know it's late and probably a lot of people here want to go and have their dinner, but it's quite a treat for me to be here. I've had an opportunity to visit with a lot of the faculty members and do a tour of the university during the day and get to meet a lot of people that I only communicate with through the computer because I'm doing an online program in astronomy. Here at Swinburne, so it's great to be here, and also I wanted to extend my personal thanks to the Iranian community, which have been very supportive of me every visit in every country and every place I've been. So thank you for being here tonight, and I have prepared a presentation that basically it's a short version of my life story, and then after that I have a video that if you endure through the presentation, it's quite a treat because you get to see a lot of the footage I took during the training and during the trip on the space station, and also a lot of images of Earth while I was there. So I think a lot of people really like that. Let's see if this is important. Okay. So I was born a long, long time ago, far, far away, in a city called Mashhad in Iran. I grew up in Iran, lived most of my life in Tehran, actually. And I came to the United States when I was 16 years old. But before that, growing up in Iran, one of my favorite pastime was to go out at nights, beautiful summer nights, and sleep on the balcony of my grandparents' house and just gaze at the stars. I was fascinated with space ever since I was very little, and just always imagined that one day I would be able to fly to space and experience this firsthand. Coming to the United States, the first thought in my mind was, great, now I'm going to a country that actually has a space program and perhaps I could become an astronaut there. Of course, the realities of life are a little bit different than what you imagine, so coming to U.S., I found out I'm not a U.S. citizen. The relationship between U.S. and Iran were not that good that back then. And I was like a lot of other immigrants who come to a new country. I was there with my family, starting life over again. Came with nothing, and I had to find a way to study, graduate, find a job quickly, support myself, pay back the loans, and support my family. So at the time, electrical engineering, telecommunication was a growing field. I knew I could get a job quickly. It was related to science and math, which I really liked and enjoyed. And so that's what I did. I studied electrical engineering, and I graduated from George Mason with a bachelor, and then George Washington. I hope to add Swinburne to that list quickly, hopefully. And then started a career in telecommunication with my husband, and started our first company, which was very successful. But throughout all this time, going through school and building a company and becoming an entrepreneur and an engineer, my passion for space, my passion for astronomy, never went away. Probably many people would have given up on it and just thought of it as a childhood dream and just said, yeah, it was a nice dream and moved on. But for me, it was, I didn't feel complete without pursuing that passion. It was a strong, strong belief inside of me that I wanted to make sure that one day I would fly to space. I was very vocal about it. My entire family knew that's what I wanted to do. My husband knew the moment we got married. I told him that, you know, nothing will make us part from each other. The only thing is that if they offer me a one-way trip to space, you know I have to take that. I can't take that. So he got married with eyes open. And a lot of people actually ask me that, what is it about space that makes it so special? Why am I so passionate about it? Of course, the mystery of it is what attracted me to it. But the more and more I learned about it, I realized that it is really important. And it plays a big role in our everyday lives. And many of you may be sitting here and not thinking about any of these things having to do with space technology. You look at this and their sports gear and game consoles and things like that. But a lot of the technology used in many of the things we use in our everyday lives are from material that was developed in the space program, or technology that was developed in the space program. And a lot of the technology developed for space program helps us detect and find problems here on Earth that affects our everyday lives and help us to find solutions for that. So I believe that space research plays a big role, and it will continue to do so in the future, help us find new types of medicine. A lot of the telemedicine technology was developed because of the space program. They're continuously doing research for new types of material that can be developed in microgravity environment of space. So in short, I think our future as a species and our success in continuing a successful, safe life on this planet depends on the space program. So I hope that it becomes more than just a sideline project for politicians that whenever they have extra money, they throw at it, or if they have a little bit of publicity, they throw money at it. It has to become an important part of the policymaker's decision. But because of the fact that it has not been an important part for a lot of programs in different countries, and it's been subject to just government agencies, it has become sort of like a distant dream. But we can go back in time and see that has happened in the past. For example, computers. In the past, maybe in the 40s and in the 50s, if you told someone that computers will be part of individuals' everyday lives, they would probably laugh at you. They thought computers were made for universities, banks, and very large companies. Of course, there were dreamers out there that believed that that should not be the case. There is no reason why this technology should be locked up in a large room in the basement of a university. So these dreamers made their dreams come true. And with that, they changed our lives and played a big role in our lives. and in the industry that was surrounding the technology for computers. These transistors, for example, back then would have cost about $6 each. So how many transistors do you think you can buy with $6 today? Just take a guess. That's a great guess, but I'm not there yet. But about over 500,000 transistors. So this is just to show you someone's dream turned into reality, how it can change entire industries. Same thing happened in the the aviation program. One of the guys, well, both guys, but one played a big role, major role in changing aviation. I'm not talking about the tall, handsome guy in this picture. I'm talking about the other guy. He was a Ortique was a French immigrant who came to the United States. He was a shepherd in France. He came there, started as a waiter, and then ended up as a very successful hotelier who put up a prize for someone who could do a nonstop flight from New York to Paris, a $25,000 prize. And Charles Lindbergh, in the picture, the guy shaking his hand, answered that challenge and was able to fly and win the prize in 1926, I believe. And with that, the whole industry started changing. They're the reason today I was able to fly halfway across the world and be here to, you know, talk about my experiences with you. In a short 3 years after this event, when he won the prize, the number of pilot license, application for pilot license, grew by about 300%. The number of registered aircraft increased by 400%. Number of passengers that flew on planes went from just 5,000 people a year to about 120,000 people a year. So the whole industry started changing. And my family, and with some persuasion from me, got involved with the Ansari X Prize, hoping to do the same thing for space travel, because we believe that if space is more accessible to people and the cost of access to space can be reduced, that there's a lot more than we can accomplish. So we sponsored the Ansari X Prize, which was a prize for someone who could privately build a spaceship, go to space, to edge of space, about 100 kilometers, come back, and do that again in 2 weeks. And the reason that we had this repeat in 2 weeks, part of the prize, was to show that it's a viable business opportunity, something that's repeatable. It's not just a one-off, you know, science project that actually can be turned into a business. And Bert Rutan, with his Spaceship One, was able to win this prize in 2004. I was there for all his test flights and for his final flight. It was a proud moment, and every time I go to Washington, D.C., to Air and Space Museum, where Spaceship One is hanging next to the Spirit of St. Louis, which is the plane that flew that nonstop flight, it makes me really proud to have played a small role in that. And Virgin Galactic has announced that they have plans to commercialize Spaceship Two, and they're on track on their plans to start flying commercial passengers in 2010. So I'm very excited about that, and I'll be signing one of the first people to sign up for those flights. So my life has sort of been through a lot of ups and downs, and I think part of it has to be because I'm always ready to take an opportunity and do what I feel it's right when the right time comes. And that's why I like this saying, because a lot of people say, you know, I'm lucky, and I am lucky. I was there at the right time, at the right place. But at the same time, I think chance does favor a prepared mind. So if you're not prepared, the chance may come by and you may not even notice it. So it's important to have that in mind and be ready for when the opportunity comes. And that's what happened to me. I went to Star City, and I was given the opportunity to train as a backup, just to learn about the Russian space program and to learn about the training program. We were designing a orbital prize,
an opportunity to do an orbital prize for XPRIZE Foundation. And when they told me, would you go there and train for 6 months, I said, of course I would. I mean, this was something that just to be there, the opportunity to talk to the astronauts and, you know, be able to touch the equipment that they train on. I mean, the whole concept was, you know, of course I go. And I packed my bag January 2006. I went there, not knowing ever that I would be actually flying on the Soyuz program. I arrived there, very, very cold winter in Russia. I flew from Dallas, so you know what that meant to me. Was not greeted very warmly by the Russian Space Agency because they only had three people that went through the Russian space program training, and they didn't have a lot of women training in the program for a long, long time. So I arrived there with my husband. The guy that greeted us kept talking to him, ignoring me, and he kept saying, I'm not going, she's going, you need to talk to her. And finally they started acknowledging me, but through the program, I was there to learn. I was there to make the most out of the opportunity. And with the enthusiasm I showed and just ignoring all the obstacles they tried to put in front of me, I started changing their point of view on the whole concept within a short period of time. So after the first couple of months I was there, most of the instructors, people who wouldn't even acknowledge me in the classroom because I wasn't important and I was a backup to start with, they started becoming my best friends. And they still are, and they keep in touch with me. So it was great to see that happen, and it was one of the experiences that I didn't anticipate to make these friendships. I went to the International Space Station. It's a place for astronauts to live and do research while they're in space. It's orbiting at about 220 miles above Earth, and it does about an orbit every 90 minutes. So every 90 minutes you can see a sunrise and a sunset. And it's a collaboration between 16 countries. So I tell everyone that the fact that countries could get together, people who don't even speak the same language, build things in totally different places in the world, and then fly into space and bring them together and have them just come together so beautifully and work together perfectly. It shows that if you want to work together and make things happen, you know, we can. So a lot of time politics and other things get in the way of people doing the right thing, and I hope to see that change. And I'm doing actually a sort of going around and telling people that we should mandate that all heads of states and presidential candidates should fly to space. And I believe in that because it will change their perspective on life. In order to be able to go to International Space Station, I had to train for 6 months. So as I was telling you, I went to Star City, which is the same place that, you know, they train all the cosmonauts and astronauts. We did a lot of classroom training, learning about all the systems on board the Soyuz and the International Space Station, learned about what to do in case of an emergency and emergency landing. And of course, one of my favorite training was the zero-G flights, which you can see in the corner. These are the parabolic flights, also known as Bomb and Comet. But, it was really fun. And now they do offer this, at least in the U.S., they do offer this for people who want to just experience it. And I highly recommend it. You don't get sick. They give you medication if you want to. And it's really, really a great way of experiencing how it feels to float in space. And there's nothing else in the world like it. Trust me on that. Finally, after completing the program, 3 weeks before the flight, because I was a backup, 3 weeks before the flight, the person who was supposed to fly actually failed one of his medical exams. So I was given the chance to take his place. I was sad that he couldn't go, but at the same time, I couldn't keep my enthusiasm for being able to take his seat. So I started screaming at the top of my lung. And it was, you know, one of those things that happens to you, and you sometimes wonder if you're dreaming or not. So I didn't believe at first. I thought they may be playing a practical joke on me, but then when I realized it's true, I was ready to go, and I did. September 18th, we went on the Soyuz TMA-9 to the International Space Station. This is a picture of the Soyuz capsule. There are three main parts to it. Two are the habitable area. One is the descent module, where the three of us sat next to each other in very cramped space, and you spend the first, you know, 6-7 hours of the flight in that position until you're in a safe orbit and you can get out of your seat. And then you can then go to the next area, which is a place that you have enough room for three people standing together. This is the descent module. That's where you spend your time when you're launching and then when you're returning back to Earth. Of course, being on the Soyuz for 2 days in that cramped space was worth it, because when I got to the space station, it was beautiful views out of every window you can imagine. And I showed this picture because one of my favorite pictures to point out the Persian Gulf right there. And I tell everyone that, you know, see, it's very peaceful, beautiful, nothing's going on there. I don't know what you're talking about. So this is a closer picture of that. And you can actually see the palms in Dubai from up there, International Space Station. Everything in space is fun. It's like being a kid and learning everything all over again. Eating food, taking a shower, brushing your teeth. Everything you do on a daily basis can be a fun thing when you're in space. And moving around, it's the best part of it, because you don't get to walk it. You can actually fly around the space station. And you can see some of the pictures here. I did participate in 4 experiments for the European Space Agency that had to do with measuring effects of the zero gravity environment on the human body, and also on microbial life form on board this station. And then I did take a lot of pictures and videos. I talked to a lot of students all over the world with the ham radio that's on board the station. And also, I did write the blog that became really popular. It's still on my website. If you are interested, you can go read it. And all the response I got from people around the world are also there. So the whole, I don't know why it became popular. I had never written anything publicly before that, except for papers for school projects. And even people at NASA would read it and really enjoy it and would write back to me. So I'm like, these are people who deal with astronauts on a day in, day out basis. So I think the personal touch that I guess I talked about everything, whether I was sick or happy or sad, there was nothing I was hiding. So it's there. It's anushaansari.com. So my first name, last name.com. So now is the time I show you the video. Hopefully everything is running here. Let's see.
Ever since I remember as a child in Iran, sleeping under the stars and watching the stars twinkle, it was something that I wanted to experience for myself. The mystery of the unknown out there always have been drawing me to space. The universe is calling me.
Thank you.
as I do with Nicola Turin and Michael Lopez Alegria. This is the morning of the flight. You take the bus from here and then you drive here.
And the next time we see her, she'll be 220 miles from this time.
Countdown started. It's my husband. Like this.
Or sometimes
you have a window.
Yes.
Right. Can you sleep when it is
light?
Light.
Yeah, I see. I do this. So for a few minutes, I listen to music, and then I start getting curious about what's out there. And then I come out here and sort of put myself here and watch this beautiful view outside and enjoy myself. And then sometimes it's during the daytime, like now, and I can see the clouds, the earth rotating by. I see the curvature right there.
The views from space station is amazing. From up here, everything's really peaceful. And you can't see the borders, you can't see different races, different religions. All you see is just one Earth, very peaceful and beautiful, rotating. And I think that's part of the reason I wish more and more people will be able to experience this firsthand, because talking to the astronauts and cosmonauts, they have a different perspective on life and how important it is for us to do everything in our power to preserve the only home we have in the universe.
This is RS-0ISS calling for anyone in Iran.
This is the ham
radio.
Thank you for answering my call. Do you want to speak in Farsi?
This is the kitchen dining room area. This is the water dispenser and I'm making water for my hair.
Of course, my favorite picture, Turkey there with the white dove, and a book from someone who I admire, Tarkovsky, who's considered to be the father of human spaceflight. Oh, by the way, they sent me a note. They say that the radio station's coffee ticket voted me the hottest astronaut ever.
Thank you.
seeing all the movements, you're disoriented, so they help you out of the crowd. And you really feel heavy, so you can see that in my arms are like.
Please don't stop the launch, I'll manage. I had practiced meditation, all sorts of things. But when the time came, I was just very relaxed, very happy to be there. It was very hard for my family. I did consider that I may never see them again, but it was a risk I was willing to take. And they knew this meant so much to me. I had talked about it ever since I was little, that they never once told me you shouldn't do it, it's too dangerous. So I was very lucky. I had a very, very supportive family, especially a very, very supportive husband. And it's been a blessing for me. Yes? So I, you know, it's when you go to the space station, because it's not that far off, so you see everything as you would see on Earth almost. So you see a lot of stars. But it, because the skies are much clearer, there are no clouds, there's no moisture in the air, so you see millions and millions of them. So they're really, really beautiful. So you see a lot of them. But I saw planets, but there were so many of them out there, I couldn't pinpoint and see what I was looking at, actually, when I was out there.
Did you offer that prayer, their verses, which has, I mean, somebody has promised to save you, to protect you, and then that verses at the start of the journey, that subhanallazi sakranat, did you say that prayers at the start of the way?
I was praying during my trip. I don't recall what prayers I was saying, but I was actually thanking God most of when I started, just that the fact that I was there and I was being able to realize the dream I had for a long, long time. I knew it's something that many people don't get to do, so I was just thanking God for giving me that opportunity, and then I was also praying for my family to give them strength
so they would be able to endure the whole anxiety of this trip. Yes.
Were you ready to come back? Did you want to stay in London?
Tricky question. I have different answer with my husband's. No, truly, when I arrived on the space station, I felt like I was at home. I was meant to be there. It was like, oh, I'm finally there. And the whole time I was training until I went to the space station and while I was there, I smiled the entire time. So much that people would tell me, we're tired of seeing you smile. So when I was returning, it was very emotional. I did not want to come back. The only reason that, the only thing that I was looking forward to was to see my family again. So that was the only reason. I tell my husband, if he was with me, there was no way I would come back. I tried to stay a little bit longer, but there was no chance of that. Yes.
In space, do you get tired?
You do get tired, actually, not because of physical exercise, because actually doing things a lot easier, and your body becomes lazy while you're spaced. But at least for me, I was there for 11 days, so I wanted to just be able to do everything possible, maximize my time up there, so I wasn't getting much sleep up there. And so for me, that was the reason why I was tired. The astronauts said they have a quite really difficult schedule. The entire day is planned out usually, even for, from the time you wake up, how much time you have to brush your teeth to, you have this much time to do, very complex experiments sometimes. And they cram so much in the schedule that they're usually behind. So supposedly the weekends they have time off, some time off. But there's so much behind, and then there's all these outreach programs that they do. So they're working around the clock. So it's quite difficult for them up there too. So they get tired a lot.
Perhaps two more questions, because
okay, sure.
We can just cover that.
And usually, many people say that space travel is far too expensive and far too dangerous. What would you say to that?
I would 100% agree with them, but there's no reason why it should be that way. The same way, if we didn't get the experience of doing a lot of flights and getting a lot of passengers, even aviation would be as dangerous, if not more dangerous and more expensive. So the only way we can make it safer and bring the cost down is to get more people involved, come up with new technologies, safer way of doing things, cheaper way of doing things. The Spaceship One program, the entire program from scratch, costs about $25 million. The same program, if it was in the hands of NASA, would have cost 10 times more, if not. Yes?
The last question, thank you.
I'm a science teacher, and I have some students who make cardboard satellites and pour over ground-tripping satellite photographs. But what kind of message could I give them on Monday that might inspire them to think about all the problems that they have around them here on Earth?
Should have had that one before the last one.
The thing that I tell students usually is I encourage them to, above everything else, to use their imagination all the time, to try to learn everything from their teachers, from everything is that's written in the books, everything they see around them, but that at the end, the thing that will make a difference for them is how they use their imagination combined with this knowledge. Because in order for us to get safer, cheaper way to get to space or do anything else, we need some imaginative minds and a lot of breakthroughs to come together. And that's why I spend a lot of time talking to young children, because I feel that, I don't have much hope in adults to make a change, but I think if you give the kids opportunity and empower them, they're the ones who can make a difference. So I would encourage them to use their imagination.
Okay, well, thank you, Michelle.
Thank you very much.
Before I close, and I think you might have clapped for a lot longer if I hadn't have stopped you. Before I close, Mehdi Sudi from the Iranian Society of Victoria would like to make a presentation to you. Shane.
Oh,
very short one. This is a small token of Iranian-Australian community here. You've made us proud. We love you. We support you.
Thank you.
For the achievements you've made, for the person you are, and for acknowledging and loving your country, Iran. Very much.
Beautiful flowers, and thank you for the gift. Thank you for all your support.
Thank you very much. Can't get away yet.
Okay.
Last say. Nusha's had a very busy day today. She started off talking, flying down from Sydney first, and then talking to groups of students from MLC, Scotch College, and Baldwin High School. So that was where she started the day. Then she had an interrogation. And I hope they didn't give you an oral exam from Sarah Madison and Glenn Mackey,
no,
who are teachers.
They were very kind. They didn't embarrass me.
They're going to give you an oral exam after.
Oh.
We want to get you through this before the oral exam.
I get a free pass on my class semester.
I'll pass on the basis of what you've just done there, Anisha. Then she followed that meeting with the staff from astrophysics and supercomputing. And I'm sure that was great because, as you said, these were just people that you corresponded with, Alistair Graham and others.
Yes, yes.
I saw you chatting to before.
Yes.
So that opportunity was great, but not as great as the opportunity that we've had to talk and listen to you.
You're
No, not at all. I'm just saying the truth. But what came through to me, and I'm sure to all and every one of you, was this, that the excitement, the exhilaration, the little girl excitement, really, that enthusiasm and that wonderful personality came through that video and continues to come through. I think the excitement's still there.
Absolutely.
And that's exhibited so easily through your personality and the way you presented it. So thank you very much. It's interesting. I'm not sure where you... I'm sure you'll go on and do a PhD... But I can't think of a fourth university that starts with George. George Mason, George Washington, of course, George Swinburne was the founder.
I didn't know that.
Perhaps you didn't know it, but it was written in the stars. That was a corny. I should have stopped. I should have stopped. Anusha, thank you.
Thank you.
We also have a very small gesture for you, just to say thank you. This has been a wonderful start to the Chancellor's Centenary Lecture Series.
Thank you
for giving us the opportunity to listen to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming along, because you know, it certainly wouldn't have been possible without Anusha, but it wouldn't have been possible without the wonderful audience we've had, the Iranian community, the enthusiasm, the love you have for Anusha is quite evident, and from the American side of things too, so both sides covered, bit of equity there. So thank you all for attending. Keep involved, keep looking at the website and seeing what else we're doing for our centenary, because without you, the university wouldn't exist. So thank you very much. Refreshments are being served outside, so please wander out. If you get a chance, you might be able to have a chat to Anusha. Thank you.